I thank all of you for being here today. I thank Dr. Shah. In recognition of the difficulty of him in switching roles, I had proposed that he wear a nose and glasses in order to be able to, but as with so many of my best ideas, he didn't seem to take up on them.
I did wear contacts, but I don't think that counts.
It doesn't count. So, as Dr. Shah was saying, there are many aspects of these paired Institute of Medicine reports, and I'm going to focus today on the ethics section. But you'll see immediately as I start to describe some of that stuff how it folds directly into the section that will follow, which speaks to public engagement. So there's really recommendations are buried in this 2012 report that's at the 60,000 foot level. It says adhere to ethical and professional norms in crisis standards of care. Well, that's hard to attack, very hard to disagree with that. On the other hand, it doesn't really take you very far down the road. If you were in a day, if you're in Joplin, Missouri, and everything is falling apart all around you, you pick up this handy report and you say, okay, great. You know, it says adhere to ethical norms. How is that going to get you further along in terms of figuring out, well, what do I do now? So the point of this discussion is begin to sort of engage on some of those issues. In order to do that, you do have to think, at least for a moment, about what are some ethical principles that come into play in the public health setting. Fairness is an overarching, extremely important bit of substance. The duty to care, which is kind of a two-parter, in that professionals, by virtue of our training, have an obligation to show up when people need your skills and your talents. You should come to work. At the same time, institutions that employ professionals like that have an obligation to care for their workers. You can't just assume that people should put themselves at risk and it's not your problem. One of the sad lessons in 911 is that the New York firefighters were incredibly valiant. Unfortunately, a certain number died because they didn't have walkie-talkies and phones that could communicate with the police force. So we took advantage, in a sense, of their valor. We did not back them up. It was giving them appropriate protections and tools that might have saved their lives, lives that they were willing to risk, which is a great thing. But that doesn't mean that we should value lightly that sacrifice. So it's a two-part, it's a reciprocal obligation to care. You also have an obligation to steward resources. You can't waste things when you don't, on a day when you don't have enough to go around. And you need to be able to think through how you're going to do that. You can't just start on the day of a disaster and think how you're going to use things appropriately. That must be part of what's planned in advance. So those are the substantive principles, the content. Fairness really has to do with process, right? And process principles include transparency. You should assume that the decisions that you make will be known by other people, that they will have insight into that, and they should. That is part of what makes this an ethically acceptable process. Consistency, proportionality, meaning that you're weighing things against each other. In public health, one of the most common ethical tensions is between a restriction of individual liberties and trying to do something for the public good. So if you have to restrict individual liberties, you have to make sure that you're actually getting something for that. You can't just sort of set martial law and not have some particular goal or benefit that's going to be achieved by that. So proportionality comes in there, and accountability is what, at the end of the day, public officials must embrace. So what does that mean? One translation would be to say that in austere circumstances, resource-poor circumstances, you do not have some sort of permission to simply forget ethics. In fact, those circumstances require more, not less, diligence. If you remember the television show 24, in some ways that had the opposite message. You know, we're in a hurry, there's a ticking time bomb, ethics is a luxury, forget that. Right? So that's actually a really toxic message. That's a terrible idea. That's really stupid, actually. In fact, when there's a disaster, you really need to think through ahead of time in order to get an effective response. It's very much like ACLS. If somebody rolls into the emergency room having a heart attack or they have a heart rhythm that's not consistent with life, you really don't want right then for a lot of highly skilled physicians to say, oh, wow, this is heart. Right, well, I don't, you know, what do you think? Should we give him a transfusion? Sometimes that helps. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he could use some oxygen. What do you guys think? This is really bad practice. You actually want a routinized set of things that you know are going to work most of the times. So you want people to have ready knowledge, and they go in and they say, airway, breathing, circulation, we know what to do here. And so ethics needs things like that, like that ACLS protocol. I wish it were as easy in ethics. So the challenge here is really to go from theory to practice, to take those ethical principles that we had up a minute ago and sort of use them to create something that works in the real world, that has some practical, actionable policies and practices that can come out of that, so that when a disaster strikes, people really do have in front of them, okay, that's helpful, I know what to do here, or I at least know what not to do. So here's a clip from a very moving book about the atomic bomb. This is a distressing clip. I can assure you that the larger paragraph is yet more distressing. So in this, Dr. Sasaki is a physician in Hiroshima just after the dropping of the atomic bomb. And I'll quickly go through. He worked without method, taking those nearest to him first. The casualties were pouring in from outdoors. He began to pass up the lightly wounded, and finally all he could do was to stop people from bleeding to death. I put that up there because there's been some controversy about whether or not you even need to think about crisis standards of care. But I assure you that physicians do not have some sort of chip or DNA that tells them automatically how they can do the right thing when all of the circumstances around them are different. You actually have to work it out in advance. Otherwise, well-intended, hardworking, good people will do the thing in front of them. And it's not that that's a bad thing to do, but actually you will lose lives that you need not have lost if that's how you operate. If you just do the guy in front of you and work your way through the unending line, there will be dead people at the end of it who might have been saved if you had a better rubric in front of you. So fairness, you know, fairness is really what you're going for, but how do you do that? How do you make fairness? There are a couple of things that it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that you treat everybody equally. Everybody doesn't need the same things. So it's okay, actually, to treat people differently because people are different. What you can look at include things like prognosis, level of care. If someone is just about to die, maybe that's not the person in whom you invest most of your resources. What also makes for fairness is some kind of broad agreement. It's actually that the participants in there agree that it's fair. So it's less fair if just one person sort of says, yeah, it looks fair to me, let's go. It actually is something that you need to have public deliberation about in advance. You also have to exclude irrelevant factors, race, social status, things like that. It's easy to agree that that has no role in a fair process. But there are actually things that we don't agree about. Should age play a role in allocating scarce resources? Should your job description, should it make a difference if you're a first responder, if you're a nurse? Should that count as to whether or not you get better access to skills? So a fair process, as I was saying before, is one that's transparent, it's visible to your community, it's consistent so that like people are treated alike. There's proportionality and accountability. But let's take a specific problem that is one that's appropriate for public engagement, appropriate for both professionals in taking care of disasters and people in our communities to think about. And this is one of the ones that's most controversial. When I worked for New York State and we came up with these ventilator guidelines, I spent a lot of time going around to different places in the state and also even doing some national conferences. And this is one of the questions that came up as most controversial over and over again. People had very heated views, but all along the spectrum, about whether or not healthcare workers should get something more than the regular person. And as you can imagine, it differs as to whether or not the group in front of you is composed primarily of healthcare workers or of other people. And interesting, other people are often more supportive of healthcare workers than they are themselves. So it's not that easy to predict who's going to say what, but it's quite controversial. So the answer to that, depending on who you're talking to and what you come up with, depends on a couple of different things. Should healthcare get more of things that are scarce, medical things that are scarce? It partly depends on what's your goal in doing that, what types of treatment are you talking about, and what else do you want to do? Who else might you like to benefit? So you have to really take all of those three, I would argue, into consideration to really begin to grapple with this problem. So let's see what I mean. Here's some possible goals of enhanced access for healthcare workers. For one, you might say, and I'm going to take the middle one first, you might say, you know what, these people put their lives at risk, and we're going to reward that. You come in and you're an emergency room nurse and it's a pandemic flu, well, you are right in the line of fire. So we're going to acknowledge your risk and we celebrate you. If you come back in and you need a particular type of treatment, we're going to take care of you because you took on risk. This is our thank you to you. That's actually quite different than saying, people won't come to work if they don't get this. So you might take it, that's sort of, the first one is kind of the high road. Thank you for putting yourself at risk for us. The second one is a little bit more, it's not Machiavellian, but it's a little more pragmatic. People aren't going to show. And there's actually pretty good data that suggests, there are different sorts of polls, but if you look at, if you query healthcare workers, a substantial number will say, yeah, if it's a hurricane or something, I'm definitely going to try to get in there. Pan flu, not feeling it. Not sure that I would come in if I myself were at greater risk of doing this. Let's think about that for a minute. So incentivizing attendance, maybe that might be a different goal. It's very different than returning and maintaining, returning people to work or maintaining them there. Let me just go back actually for a second. All right, let's do this one. The type of treatment makes a big difference. Actually, let me see if I can go. Can I do that? Yeah, okay. So returning and maintaining people at work. This is classic triage. So the concept of triage is actually invented by someone whose actual name is Dr. Larry, way before Three Stooges fame. He was Napoleon's battlefield surgeon and came up with the concept of triage, which divides people into three categories. One category is, actually, you're going to be fine no matter what I do. Good for you. The other category at the other extreme is, there's nothing I can do for you. You're going down. I'm not sure I should waste my battlefield resources on you because I can't save you. The guys I'm looking for, I want to get you up and back to work. I'm going to give you the good stuff. So can you apply that? Well, depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about pan flu, if you're talking about something where people have critical illness that requires a ventilator, should you give healthcare workers a ventilator? It's not going to get them back to work. You'd be lucky to save that person's life. That's what you're going for. You're trying to save a life. The pandemic should be gone before these people will be able to return to work. So if that's your goal, this is not an appropriate intervention. You might do it because you honor a fallen hero. You might do it because you want people to come to work. But if you're looking to get them back up to work, look elsewhere. Okay? Look elsewhere than the ventilator. But let's think about that. Right? So there are different kinds of treatments that can be scarce. A vaccine, well, that's really different than a ventilator. Right? A vaccine is widely available. If I don't get it this round, maybe I can get it next round. That helps take the emotional pressure off it. I could actually maybe wait on that. There's no immediate life or death choice. You haven't turned up the emotional heat on either the recipient or the donor in this the way it is for something that's a life-sustaining treatment. And this probably is effective at keeping healthcare workers at work. So if your goal is keeping people on the job, a vaccine actually may do it for you. So this is less controversial. The CDC came out with guidelines suggesting that healthcare workers have priority for getting vaccines. A lot of people said, yeah, that makes sense to me. That was not a controversial finding. As I was talking about before, ventilators, not so much. So this is genuinely scarce. And no matter how many you buy, if you have a big enough pandemic, you will not have enough. That's partly because if somebody is sick enough to require a ventilator, they need staff that can take care of them. And in a crisis like this, the thing that is most scarce will always be in the shortest supply is trained staff. So the vast majority of physicians are not competent to take care of somebody on a ventilator, right? So actually people that can do that, that can provide critical care, really scarce resource. Most medicine, outpatient medicine, a fantastic community dermatologist, pediatrician, has no business taking care of somebody in an intensive care unit. So that's your scarce resource. So buy all the ventilators you want. You can't just plug them in like you're recharging a phone. You really need a person that's going to watch over them. So this will be scarce. And there's no next round. If you need that thing, you can't get it tomorrow. You have to have it now. You don't need it unless you're about to die now. So this is a choice that's very heated up. And as I say, it's not going to get people to stay at work. So you might do it for other reasons, but you can't do it to keep your workforce on the job. So this is much more controversial. And if your goal is maintaining the workforce, it's much less effective. Well, what about this? I'll tell you, when I was traveling around the country, it was pretty clear that there's one group that everybody likes. If you sort of take a straw poll and say, who would you like to get stuff if there's not stuff to go around? Everybody loves kids. Who's not going to love kids? Who do people not love? There's a couple of groups that people don't love. that people are willing to say out loud, I don't want those guys to get it. So who what's your guess? Who do people not love so much? Prisoners. Yes, prisoners is number one. And with a little bit of like apologetic language, who comes out number two? No, not the elderly.
Immigrants,
I didn't hear that much, but I bet it would come up now. Disabled, actually. The disabled came up a lot. All right, so what about those people? You know, they're not thinking Christopher Reeve. They're thinking somebody in a chronic facility who's on a vent. I'm going to go in there and get that vent. You know, I don't want, you know, people who are like, you know, up and around, like, oh, why should that guy get a vent? People have very strong feelings about who they value. It is very interesting and challenging in a public engagement process when people come up and say, well, I'm right next to a prison. There's no way I'm giving it to those. Those are bad people. So that's actually against the law. So there are ethical intuitions and really profound ethical desires. There are also ones that are so profound that we've taken the trouble of translating them into law. So there's really a hard stop. You cannot say by virtue of somebody's status as a prisoner that they don't get access to the same health care that other citizens do. In fact, for many people who are from disadvantaged groups and are poor and from minorities, their better health care is when they're in prison. That's the best attention, particularly for the mentally ill offender. That's the best health care they're likely to see while they're behind bars, because we don't fund that in the community as a separate thing. So let's return to children. It's a really interesting issue. The CDC funded, because the CDC was appropriately distressed to see that in a lot of crisis planning documents, kids came in as kind of a little aside or an addendum. So they funded a group that focused particularly on children. And they came up with some interesting things. First of all, kids, you know, bless them, they're generally pretty healthy. They haven't had enough time to accumulate chronic illnesses. So there are many fewer ICU beds per capita for children than for grown-ups. Well, that's a problem. In a flu pandemic, they're actually at greater risk than the rest of the population because they haven't seen variations on bad bugs. They haven't got enough of a sort of library of immunologic reactions going on yet. So they're at particular risk. And third, they bounce back. The mortality rate in a pediatric ICU is like a tenth of what it is in an adult ICU. So here's a group for which there's fewer resources, they're more at risk, and actually if you give them the resources, you will save lives, young lives, that will go on for a really long time. That's what you want to do, right? That sounds like a good group to help. So everybody wants to do that. It's really hard to find somebody who's going to argue against that. So CDC in that recommendation in the ethics chapter said, actually, what we think you should do is in certain sorts of crises, you should move the bar on admission to your adult ICU. Take it down and get kids in there who are more or less the size of adults, depending on how much they're affected, how many kids are getting sick, how many pediatric ICU beds you've got. But you might want to dial admission age in your adult ICU down to, say, 12 or 13. That's going to put a lot of heat on beds in your adult ICU. So if you do that, if you want to get better treatment for kids because they're at risk, because we love them, and because they actually will respond to treatment even when they're really critically ill, you're going to have fewer adult ICU beds. You also want to put in your healthcare workers. And by the way, you're not going to get away with just putting in healthcare workers. You'd have to include first responders in there. So now your group is getting kind of bigger. You're not going to get in the doctors and nurses without the firefighters and the police. And then you're probably going to have to do EMS. But in a lot of places, the EMS guys are volunteer and part-time. So that actually starts to be kind of a bigger and bigger circle. You're out of beds. You are out of beds. Nobody in your community is going to get a bed if that's how you're setting it up. So nobody likes that. So now you've got some severe shortages. I wish, now here's the part where you're not going to like me. I don't have an answer for you. I'm just telling you, if you want to walk through this, these answers are not easy. You can't say, yeah, I want a pony. You have to really figure out, how are you going to do that? Who's going to go without? If you want a pony, you have to think about mucking out the stall every day. Right, so this is the mucking out the stall of the notion of, yeah, we love healthcare workers, let's give it to them, let's give it to kids. There's only so much to put it, to give out to people. So you really need to think about how you're going to do that. To address these ethical tensions, you have to do a couple of things. You have to keep people in the public engagement process and with your policymakers within the range of ethically acceptable solutions. So when somebody says inevitably, forget the prisoners, you have to say, I hear what you're saying. You know, this is certainly an unpopular group. Because of that, we've long ago decided that in our democracy, we don't want to live in such a way that somebody, because they've been a felon, doesn't get access to health care. So that's against the law, because we've really enshrined that. That's not how we want to live. We don't want to do that to felons. In my teaching, there are occasionally will be a student who says, yeah, no ethics, there's no right answers, there's no wrong answers. It upsets me when they say that. Actually, there really are wrong answers. There are some terrible answers. Among the things that you want to do ahead of time is identify those bad actors, figure out what's the wrong answer here, and how can I move away from that? There are genuine hard stops, things that you ought not to do, and if you have some education and you have some planning, there should be a floor that you can set beyond which you hope people will not go. And transparency is really part of that. If people assume that what they're doing will be visible to everybody, it changes the way people operate. When you talk to people who have been in really terrible situations, have faced really just heartbreaking dilemmas in providing care in disasters, they sort of felt like no one was there to help me. I didn't know what to do. I'd been haunted by my choice for years now. There was a chopper coming. There were three incredibly obese people, and I let them stay there. I put the skinny people on the chopper. Was that right? I don't know. So you have to give people some kind of tools ahead of time and some notion that they can go back to work, they can live with what they've done, and there was a way of sort of addressing what was happening here. To do that, it's great. You've really got to work with your community and figure out what's going on. And your government has to get in there, too, and embrace this process with people. It's so unpleasant, it's so frightening, that it's hard, actually, to engage people and get them to talk about it. In not doing that, though, you buy yourself an eternal procession of Katrinas. You really, by not revisiting these issues, by not coming up with a better solution, you really will be destined to repeat the problems of the past. So what's the conclusion? The devil is really in the details. You have to drill down. You need some theory as a starting place, but I agree it doesn't take you very far down the road. You really need to think about specific challenges. Where did we go wrong in the past? What can we learn from that? What were the lessons learned? How can we have thought how to do this better? That really comes to our duty to plan. And in that planning, to incorporate community values. How are we going to do this? How are we going to do specific things? How do you evacuate people in the Katrina scenario? How do you prioritize that? It's a terrible, terrible problem. Best not left to people who've been awake for 4 days in 100-degree heat without food and water. We also have to say that we have to support in training people in treating, in providing public health care in disasters. You have to support the notion that ethical reflection is part of being an expert, is part of being a professional. That's what you do. It isn't a luxury. It is a core requirement. And in fact, if you don't know how to do the ethical part, you don't know how to do your job. That you are not a competent professional without some grasp on these issues and some knowledge of how to work them through. And after action, if people mess up, and because we're human, we will, and because each disaster is a little bit different, or a lot different than the one that went before, people will make mistakes. The point then is not necessarily to collar people who at least showed up for work and were trying to do the right thing, but to figure out what could we have given them in advance? What support should they have had? What communication tools? What education? How could we have given the frontline providers better resources so that they could do a better job and we can do a better job next time? So I think I'll leave it for now. Now we give back the nose and glasses to Dr. Shah, and he comes back up again.